If you negotiate with your knee before standing up, you're losing that argument. Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000 as in zero pain.
Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on a Thursday afternoon. Dennis Rodkin in the studio as well. A little bit later, as I said, we're going to talk robots. Both robots are going to take your job, and then the development of them and how innovation is leading to all sorts of things you can do with robots. And then Dennis at the end, you know, the Super Bowl is coming. And, well, it's the biggest day of the year for Italian beef. So I thought it would be nice to have a Chicago treasure in, as we do from time to time. And
so both, is there a robot delivering the food?
I don't know who's delivering the food. No, I'm not even talking about a delivery of food. I'm talking about a guest.
We're bringing it to you.
Bone of beef, yeah, a little bit later in the show. But first, Super Bowl this weekend. I had no idea until recently that the post-Super Bowl weeks were considered sort of the beginning of the house sale season.
Yeah, you know, it in a way, it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy or a self-perpetuating cycle of the real estate industry is that the more people think, you know, I want to get an early jump on that spring market. I didn't have my house on during Christmas and January, that sort of thing. So what's the earliest I can get on? And the Super Bowl has become sort of a benchmark. Why don't you get on right after the Super Bowl? Even though there is traffic, there are people who look at houses in December and in January. So it has sort of become kind of a convention that if you want to be the early bird on the market, right after the Super Bowl is a good time.
Oh, get this. I looked we've lived in our house for 20 years now. We looked at it the first time, Super Bowl Sunday.
There you go.
So 20
years
ago.
You were the precursor to the trend.
Who would have thought? If you want to look at some homes, there are a few in Burr Ridge and Lake Forest that probably have a few open houses this weekend.
Yeah, there are. Yeah. Those are the two I just reported this week on the towns that have the biggest inventory backlog as well as the smallest at the other end. And at the biggest, at the upper end, you've got Burr Ridge, Lake Forest with enough houses to feed 10 months of sales already on the market. The idea of that story was, you know, if you're looking at Super Bowl Sunday and wondering, yeah, I've been trying to get it. Should I get it on? What's the nature of the local market I'm in? In Burr Ridge, in Lake Forest, you'd be entering a very crowded field if you put your house on the market. However, in Hanover Park, 2 months of inventory. So again, over 10 months in Burr Ridge and Lake Forest, 2 months of inventory in Hanover Park, meaning it's very likely that if you get your house on, it's going to go right off the market very quickly.
All right. So, you know, I would say that the cost of the house has to do with that or not? I mean,
well, you know, all the others that were down at that end were also lower cost areas. It's not always true, but it is true at this time that the places with the least inventory do all seem to be lower cost places. One of the reasons is going back to that upper end. I'm more likely, if I'm listing my house in Burr Ridge or Lake Forest, to have a lot of money, have a lot of time. I may even have another home, so I can wait for my price to come along, or I think I can, although real estate agents say, let's right. not go that strategy.
That's a long way of saying an unrealistic price.
Yeah, I can put it on while the people in the Hanover Parks and the other towns at that end of the list need, it's their only asset in many cases. And if I'm going to get another house, I need to sell this one. So I've got to be serious about what the market is telling me, price it to move, and get moving.
I like a quote you have from Tracy Worcester from Berkshire Hathaway. She says, when inventory is so high, you either need to have your house in the top 10% of the prettiest or the bottom 50% on price.
Yeah, I think she actually said it's got to be both, right? When inventory is that high, it's both got to be very pretty.
Oh, it is. I misread
that.
And
it's got to be priced well. While in Hanover Park, that's not to say that in Hanover Park you can put a dump on the market.
Right.
You should still have a really attractive home, but it's just less likely that you're going to sit and wait and wait. It takes several price cuts before you move the
house. Let's go to Humboldt Park, where there are protests over the high costs of homes coming in. The idea is property values might be going up, and a lot of people who live there don't like it.
Yeah. A developer announced in early January that he was taking a lot of a five-lot site that had one house on it, putting five new homes on it. So no new zoning or anything. But he's building houses priced at over $900,000. $929,000 is the price. And when word got out, then a couple of activists scheduled a protest for this past Saturday where they said this is too expensive for people who live in the neighborhood.
And is this about the 606 Park?
Well, the protest isn't specifically about the 606.
No, but I mean, is the value, the property value?
Yeah, he's building just half a block off an entrance to the 606. And what he said to me was, just a couple years ago, I'd have had to build at a few $100,000 less. It was less affluent people who were pushing to get there. Now, everybody wants to be near the 606. And if I'm affluent, I can more likely afford to get what I want. So he's going at the $900,000 level. And some people in the neighborhood thought, you know, that's not appropriate. But I did find other homes that have sold in the 800s, all right around near there.
So it's probably happening that the property values are going up there.
Well, those were new homes that were built in that range. Yes, it is true. That's over in the sort of eastern part of Humboldt Park, where you're getting the spillover from the Wicker Park and Bucktown sort of an area. And one thing to keep in mind, you know, this has happened in the city. I'm not necessarily defending the guy.
No, but it's...
But this has happened for... I mean, Lincoln Park was a lot different 35, 40 years ago than it is today. There are so many neighborhoods that have changed.
Let's go from where a $900,000 home is expensive to where... A $10.7 million home fits right in.
Yeah, where a $10.7 million home is now planned. Yeah, well, actually, and that's in one of the parts of Lincoln Park that 30, 40 years ago.
Not even that. I mean, when I lived in that neighborhood 25, 30 years ago.
See, and you left and the neighborhood went up. I think that's the real estate rule we're learning.
But this one on Fremont is what? It's on five lots?
It's proposed for three lots. So the developer has owned two lots for several years and was offering to build a house on those two lots. He's just about to buy the third lot, the one immediately north, so he can go from offering you about a 7,000 square foot house to offering you an 11,000 square foot house.
Thank God.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and the good news is it can actually take a house up to 14,000 feet. His designs, you know, it'll all be designed by the buyer, but what his sort of conceptual design is 11,000 square feet at $10.75 million.
We need to organize a business lunch Dennis Rodkin house walk through that neighborhood. Right?
Or a fundraising drive so I can get that house.
It would take us 5 minutes to walk from one house to the next.
It's true. Seems like. From one room to the next in that house.
More from Dennis Rodkin at chicagobusiness.com. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks, Steve.
Listening to the Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand on this Thursday afternoon. And if you are at work, look around. Maybe a robot's next to you. If not, maybe a robot will be soon. Steve Goldstein writes for MarketWatch. In fact, he's the Washington Bureau Chief. And he wrote about robots in the workplace recently. Caught my eye. And I'm glad we were able to find a time to talk. Steve, welcome to the Business Lunch. Steve, hello, Steve. Can you hear me? Well, Steve, were you able to hear me here? We'll try one more time. Steve, welcome to the Business Lunch. We're having a bit of a hiccup problem there, so we're trying to get to Steve Goldstein. Anyway, the story is, and I'm gonna put Steve on hold there, Yun, see if you can grab him. The story is there was a report out of, I think it was out of London, a university study, and they looked at the number of jobs around Great Britain and the U.S., that were susceptible to sort of a takeover by robots. And it looks as if in the U.S. they're saying that maybe as many as 80 million jobs could soon be replaced by robots. They listed the number of cities that were impacted as well. And the city most at risk of losing jobs to a robot is Fresno, California, and then Las Vegas, Nevada. The city least likely to lose jobs to a robot is Washington, D.C. And I think that speaks to exactly what is at threat. The sort of mechanical work is more likely to be replaced by a robot than would be, say, a creative job. We were talking to Wendy before the show started about what jobs might be at risk here and whether radio jobs were. And the answer really is not so much, because that takes more thinking on your feet, believe it or not, and creativity. All right, we're going to give it another shot. Steve Goldstein, can you hear me this time?
I can hear you great.
Right. I'm glad you're with us. Tell me, I was just saying before that I think this study came out of Great Britain in the fact that 80 million jobs might be at risk in the U.S. I mean, are they talking about next year, 5 years from now, 10 years? What kind of timetable are you looking at here?
Yeah, it's a longer time frame. I would say maybe 5 to 10 years. It could be longer than that. And just because a job is at risk from automation doesn't mean the job will disappear. A classic example of that would be a cashier. We see that is absolutely a job at risk of automation. We've all used automated checkouts. At the same time, people still have that job. So that's sort of the way to think about it. That, you know, these are jobs that there's some degree of risk of being replaced by robots. And I think, as I caught you saying, in the media business, it's probably less of a risk, although we have more than our share of risk from other issues.
Forget about the robots.
Yeah. So, just because you're at risk from a robot doesn't mean the job's going to be eliminated. And just because you're not at risk of having a job taken by a robot doesn't mean you're necessarily in a great position. I think those are two points to make.
All right. How about in history, when technology grows and innovation creates new abilities, do the number of jobs go down? Or do the number of jobs just sort of move elsewhere? I mean, do they move in support in one way or another? Might it be that 80 million jobs are gone to robots, but maybe another 65 are created to service robots?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's traditionally, improved technology helps productivity, which then helps both standard of living and the job outlook. There are fewer people making horse carts. However, we have the car industry. Then that's been the traditional situation. The question really we have to ask, will that continue? How much more room is there to grow? But in the past, generally speaking, technology over the longer term has been a help. The question we're all kind of wondering about after seeing, pretty weak growth, I would say, in jobs over the last few years. The official productivity numbers, in fact, we just had some today, have not been very good. So that's making people wonder, maybe we've hit this situation where new technology may not help the economy. So, these are difficult issues. And, one of the suggestions, for example, in this research is, well, maybe in the future we should have shorter work weeks. That would be a benefit from the perspective, well, you have less time to work, but also potentially damaging the fact, you'd have less money to spend. So, we're not sure kind of where this is taking us.
Steve Goldstein, the Washington Bureau Chief for MarketWatch.com. Look, I'm glad that the robots aren't threatening your job. You're safe from the robots. Thanks for taking time to talk to us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You bet. When we come back, we will talk about the development of robots and what they might be doing for us soon. Wearable robots. That's from Ian Schur from CNET, right around the corner. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. All right, we were talking just a few minutes ago about robots taking your job. Let's meet the robots. Let's get a little closer look at those robots we were talking about. Ian Schur is here. He writes for CNET and joins us from time to time to talk about what's new in technology. Ian, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Look, I'm fascinated by this article written by Max Taves. Did I pronounce that correctly, Max Taves?
Yes.
Headline, Wearable Robots for the Paralyzed Take a Step Forward. And he writes about this new robot, an exoskeleton, I guess, built by SuitX. It costs around $40,000, 27 pounds, and can help paraplegics walk maybe about a mile in an hour, sort of slowly, but it allows them to walk. And I mean, that's just one of the entries when it comes to wearable robots now in this world that we live in.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. The ability to create smart technology that actually helps people who are paralyzed and don't have full use of their bodies is really fascinating. And there's all sorts of indications of where this is going. There are robotic arms out there now. People are using 3D printing to come up with cheaper and lighter versions of all these robotic things. And as you mentioned, there's now this exoskeleton that someone can put on that will actually allow a paralyzed person to walk. Not very fast, but it's a start. And it came out of UC Berkeley. And so it's really fascinating to watch this stuff happening. And, of course, there are other applications for it as well. Part of what's driving all of this is the military, which really wants to have kind of super soldiers, right? And so by creating all these different technologies for military people, both in the field but also when they're hurt in the field and help them with, you know, replacing limbs that are blown off in combat, this is really helpful for all of those types of things. And that's what's driving this industry to push forward and come up with new ideas.
I like the idea that what they're using it for the military, one of the things they want to do is to increase the endurance of the soldiers wearing them. I'm not sure I quite understand that, if they take away some of the strain from carrying or how that would work, but it's an endurance issue there. And I read about, is it at Panasonic where the guys in the warehouse now are wearing these exoskeletons to help them lift things?
Yes, exactly. And in fact, I mean, first off, the military asks their soldiers to do quite a bit. And among the things they have to do is carry these very heavy backpacks everywhere they're going. And sometimes when they're traveling different places, they even have extra batteries for their radios and whatnot. And these things can get very heavy. And so with an exoskeleton on, for example, they can carry 4 or 5 times more comfortably than they would be otherwise. And so a lot of what the promise of this stuff is not just to help them be better in combat, but actually to be able to just do their jobs logistically. And even if you look at Amazon, for example, the retailer who sells us all books and baby doctors and everything, they have started using robots, not exoskeletons, but robots in their warehouses, actually moving stuff around so that people can easier find things and they don't have to go walking up and down all these aisles. There are all these different ways that this technology is being used, and it's really helping to make things a lot easier, particularly for people who are either disabled or have very manual jobs.
Yep, exoskeletons, robots, they can help with stroke victims and things like that, too. Fascinating. We've got a few minutes left. I want to talk about a couple of other things while you're here. I was reading about this, is it a startup called Magic Leap, where they don't do virtual reality. They're calling it mixed reality. They've been very successful at raising money, and they haven't really shown anyone what they're doing. That's quite a trick.
It's quite a trick, and it's one I wish I could pull off. So they've raised almost $1.4 billion. They're valued at $4.5 billion, with a B. And the most amazing thing is that most people have no idea what their product looks like. Only a few people, including the MIT, someone there, have actually been able to see it and talk about it. And so the idea is really interesting, right? This idea that we can put a computer screen in front of us and basically overlay computer images on the real world. So imagine being able to have like a cartoon character suddenly jump on my table and talk to me. That's a really fascinating idea. And a lot of people are very engaged in this and very interested in seeing where it can go. And so you've got now Warner Brothers, Alibaba, a number of different high-profile executives investing nearly $800 million just in the last week in this Magic Leap thing.
It's funny to me.
We don't know where it's going. We don't know how big it'll be. You know, there are estimates that will be worried that the industry may get as high as $120 billion by 2020, but it's really hard to tell where it's all going, which is why it's fascinating watching it happen.
It's interesting to me that it's called mixed reality, and as an example, you talk about a guy eating cereal and having a cartoon character standing on the table and talking to him, because that sounds to me like mixed realities of the 60s, maybe an LSD trip or something like that. So now with technology...
So it's actually making it possible.
What's that?
Right? Back in the 60s, it was all theory, and everyone thought it might happen, and there were a lot of things where they were making movies, but no one actually believed it would happen. Now we're here. We're actually possibly going to have all this stuff where computers lay over images on the real world all the time, and that's a really fascinating idea. It's also kind of scary for those of us who just want to be relaxed sometimes and don't have computer things coming at us all the time.
All right, we got less than a minute left, but the big news this week, they talk about Gmail has more than 1 billion users. And the thing that struck me about that story is, you know, they've incorporated this smart reply where they offer like quick, easy responses to your emails. I don't know if they're automated or what, but they're saying that 10% of the inboxes in Gmail are made up of these smart replies. So that tells me that, speaking of robots, that the people who are responding to emails aren't even doing it themselves anymore.
Yeah, in fact, it's funny. A lot of the smart reactions are happening throughout the industry. If you have an Apple Watch, for example, or even a Pebble or an Android Wear, any of these smartwatches, you know, it's very hard to type out a response to a text message. They actually will automatically think through and figure out what a good response is and offer it to you. So if my wife asks me, do I want ham or eggs for breakfast, it will actually just have a response that I can choose ham or eggs. And so a lot of this stuff is happening because they realize that we're not going to be able to keep up with all these things unless computers start helping us. And that's really where it's all coming from.
I don't know.
If we can get computers to help us, it's great.
We've done pretty well for thousands of years on our own, but it seems like now we can't order ham and eggs without a computer. I'm not sure that's forward thinking.
Well, I couldn't tell you there. You know, the reality is that that a lot of this stuff is that we are in a communicative world where we are connected 24/7. I don't know about you. I get hundreds of emails a day.
Yeah, I do.
So anything that can be done to cut down on that is really where people are striving to go.
Good point. We'll end it there. Ian Scher from CNET, thanks for joining us today on the Business Lunch.
My pleasure.
Speaking of business lunches, we're going to talk about Super Bowl food in just a few minutes. But first, this on 720 WGN. It's 12:51 on the Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. I'm Steve Bertrand. Hope you'll follow me on Twitter, at Steve Bertrand. Joe Bonavolanto is in the studio as well. I know the first half of that name, Bono. Means Italian beef. Joe, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
All right, so tell me about it. So Bona Beef and you are Joe Bonavolanto the third.
I'm the third.
Mm-hmm. Did the first started? Is he the guy?
He did, yeah. That's my grandfather. Him and my grandmother, they took a family recipe and that was carried on for many generations.
So what's in the recipe, Joe?
Oh, I can't tell you that,
Steve. Take your time. You can tell me whatever you want to tell me.
You know what? Not today.
And I'm thinking about the Super Bowl, and everyone thinks about chicken wings or guacamole, right?
Yep,
the avocados
sure.
Everywhere. And then I find out from a buddy that it's the biggest day of the year for Italian beef in Chicago.
Yep, absolutely. This Super Bowl weekend, we're going to sell about 10,000 pounds of beef, which equates anywhere from 40 to 50,000 sandwiches.
Can I tell you, I was at, it was in the 90s when Dallas was so good. And a buddy of mine, best man at my wedding, had moved on to Dallas. So I went down there, and we're going to watch the Super Bowl. And I said, yeah, let's make some Italian beef. And they had no idea. So I mean, let's go to a supermarket. I'm sure they're selling Italian, like some frozen stuff.
Yeah.
Or nothing. They had no idea. How regional is it to here?
You know, it's pretty regional. In the Midwest market, that's where we get a lot of play with the Italian beef. This weekend, actually, we're doing a Costco road show.
I want to hear about these Costco roadshows.
Sure.
So you've got, what, 16 stores now, 17 stores?
We have 16 locations. Number 17 is opening up sometime in March in Beverly,
okay.
107th and Western.
And how much do you expect to expand this year?
Well, we're going to open up another three this year. The next one will be Algonquin in June, Frankfurt in August, and then Flossmoor towards the end of the year.
So do you have people calling you saying, hey, we want a Bono beef?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Do you ever listen to them?
Well,
I mean,
you know
I'm
what?
Sure you
I
listen
to all
them.
My customers,
right.
But you know, my brother Michael and my uncle and my cousin Joey, they handle right. The real estate portion, so they're looking at sites every day.
If people are listening right now and they're angry that a Bona Beef's not in their town, you're saying it's not your fault.
Not my fault.
Tell me about the Costco roadshows, because I was reading about this. I'm interested in you've been taking the product to Costco
mm-hmm.
With the idea that maybe you'll get placement in the store.
Yeah, so that's the idea. We were lucky enough to get a test through the Costco people. And last weekend, we had a successful road show in Naperville, Orland Park, and Schaumburg. And this weekend, we're back in South Loop and Mount Prospect. So if we sell enough units, hopefully we'll have a permanent spot in the freezer.
So the idea is you're at Costco not to find out if you've got Bona beef eaters at Costco, because you've got Bona beef eaters everywhere.
Thank you.
But you're trying to convince Costco to put you on their shelves.
Correct. So that's the whole idea. You sell enough units and we make our case.
So, you know, I hadn't really thought of that. So when I'm walking around Costco and people are giving me samples,
mm-hmm.
that's not necessarily just strictly an in-store promotion. They're maybe trying out products too.
Sure. Yeah. So my understanding is they do samples every day, and then they do the
yes,
road.
They do,
the road
Joe.
Shows
yeah.
are for companies like Bona,
okay.
where we were able to showcase our signature item and hopefully get in there.
All right. So let's go back to the Super Bowl then. The Italian beef obviously is the center of all this, but I mean, what is it that you think? What's the second most popular day for Italian beef?
For Italian beef, well, last year we did National Beef Day, which was pretty successful.
Yeah.
But in terms of catering, it's definitely the Christmas season.
Okay.
Between New Year's Eve and Christmas Eve, we sell a lot of beef.
So then maybe between Christmas Eve and through the Super Bowl is your busy time of year?
Yep. And then the next season is graduation season.
Right.
So we get a little pop
a lot
during
of catering.
Those times. Correct.
Okay. So tell me about the beef. You said it's a secret recipe.
Uh-huh.
What are you? I'm not going to try to get it out of you. You're like laughing like I'm going to try to get it out of you, Joe. Come on. What's in the beef? Tell me.
Well, you know what? You could call my Uncle Johnny. he'll be more than happy to have a couple words with you about
it. How much
it.
Of it is a family business with you guys?
Oh, we're 100% family
yeah.
owned.
Was there ever a chance you were not going to work at Bona Beef?
There was a period of time where I did have another job after college for
right.
experience, but I had every intention of coming
Always
back coming to Bona.
Back. What'd you do to get experience?
Well, I got a finance degree. I worked at the Board of Trade for 2 to 3 years. I guess it was 3 years. And I came back, worked at Bona as a manager, and now I'm the Director of Training and Development.
Joe Bonavolanto from Bona Beef. Listen, I wish you success at Costco.
Thank you very much.
You're almost guaranteed success. So we should tell people if they're out at Costco, you want to buy Bona Beef there, you should go and get a sample and pick some
Absolutely.
Up, right?
Absolutely.
Real quick, there's a promotion for the Super Bowl too?
Yeah. So in our restaurants, if you make a purchase on catering of $50 or more and you register your receipt online at Bona.com, you're able to get your order for free if the score of the Super Bowl ends in 50.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So if it's like 48 to 12, you get your catering bill for free.
Well, 38 to 12.
Right, whatever it is, but it adds up to 50.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get all those email addresses, don't you,
Joe? Oh, yeah.
Joe Bonavolanto, thanks for coming by. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN.